You are listening to a production of the Toho Network, home of Biting Analysis. This is Moonspeak, Phase 2, Episode 34, No Greater Love.
This is Sana.
And I'm Amit. Welcome to Moonspeak, Phase 2, your source for weekly Sailor Moon Crystal Season 3 discussion and analysis. Let's see, this week we're discussing Sailor Moon Crystal 38, Act 37, Infinity 11, Infinite Judge.
Yes.
I'm not sure I've really noticed, that Infinite in there. I thought it was, like, Infinity. Like, the last couple episodes started injecting Infinite in there in a weird way, right?
Yeah.
Like, at episode 9? Or, like, Infinite 9, maybe? Was that Upper Atmosphere? Maybe.
Yes.
Well, it doesn't really matter. It's just a really weird thing that stuck out in my mind, because I just kept writing it, and it just didn't seem right. And I think it's because it's kind of unnatural, but whatever.
It may be because we have Infinite and Infinity right next to each other.
It could be.
In that weird, you know, wizard ghost way.
Yes, I was going to say. And then you've got Mugen and Infinity form, and just, anyway.
This word is all over the place lately.
And Infinity's crystalline. Anyway, so.
And then you've got the world.
Yes, and that's awkward to talk about. I love that. Somebody needs to feed the world. Yes, this is true. That would be wonderful. Anyway.
It works on so many levels.
It really does. We're bringing back a ad hoc segment, and it's Glimpsed in the Water Mirror. And this week, what was Glimpsed in the Water Mirror was the fact that Usagi broke my heart, and then Mamoru did, and then Chibiusa did too.
Yeah, just heartbreak, left and right, as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, pretty much. Let's go ahead and get on to our rough amounts. And we're going to be a little looser with the format this time, because I kind of did it by rote, like some of the note formatting, and then like I realized that I was crying through so much this episode that I couldn't really focus that much on like structuring a way to talk about it. So we're going to be kind of loose. But I sure wish they hadn't replayed a good deal of the concluding scene from last episode at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, there was a lot in this episode that felt like it was there just to fill time. Like all of that, some other animation from previous episodes, with the whole Hotaru conversation, a lot of reaction shots. And like normally I'm fine with reaction shots as, you know, a way to emphasize drama, but there were at least one or two parts where there were two full cycles of reaction shots from all 10-ish observers for every like one thing that was going on. And it was a bit much.
Yeah, I kept thinking about this episode, and like, I wonder where it fits in with the manga. Like, is this splitting a manga chapter in half? Is that what's going on here to kind of like balance out the drama? And maybe they didn't have enough, so they're just like, you know, we got to slow it down with filler for this little bit so that we can have a better second part of the episode.
Yeah, maybe. I don't quite remember how these chapters break down, but maybe that's it. It's just very weird how much time was used on certain things.
I mean, and part of the problem is, like I was referring to, like, they're referencing the manga. And, like, I remember I watched all of Fruits Basket, and then I read the manga, and I was astonished that, like, the manga was kind of like the key art for the anime, which makes sense when you say it, but it shocked me because I hadn't read at that point. I hadn't watched an anime and then read its manga until that, and I read through, I think, all of it, and I was just, like, amazed by two things. One, like, that key art, like, how derived from the manga the anime is, mm-hmm. and also, like, how much the pacing was different between, you know, or from one to the other. And, like, one of the magical things about manga, I guess maybe just well-crafted manga, or maybe all of it, is, like, you set the pace for it. So it never feels too fast or feels too slow, typically, except maybe a fight scene if it's not well, like, blocked. But, anyway, I just think that's kind of interesting, and I wonder how much that factors into all of this. Because, like, if it was just a manga chapter, you'd be able to read it at your own pace, and it might be chock full of stuff, but it might need to be more than one episode in order to actually work in animation.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
No, I definitely agree, because, like, you can fit maybe 5 sentences onto a page, and the reader will read them at their own pace. And, you know, some people read faster, some people read slower, but when you put that into animation, it takes up an allotted amount of time, regardless of who's watching it. So it may just be something with the pacing on that level, with the way that they broke up the chapter. But I didn't go back and, you know, check the manga chapters for this, and I don't quite remember how that broke down, but it was very, very odd, some of their pacing decisions. But we'll see if it, you know, pays off in the next episode.
Yeah, definitely. So, even Saturn and swinging her glaive around a few times, it was like, are you an ROTC? What's going on? that's seriously what it made me think of. But, like, you know, something else I found odd was, like, Usagi calling upon the power of the 9 planets, given that Hotaru is dead at this point, and that kind of threw me off. I don't know.
9 guardians, not 9 planets. She was probably counting Chibiusa or Mamoru, since, you know, he gets Earth. Earth is his.
Right.
So I'm not sure which of them she was counting, but it was, you know, one of the two of them, most likely.
Okay, that would make sense. Yeah, I guess I missed that distinction while I was watching. Or, I conflated it after the fact, whatever. Okay, so, moving on to Frills. I really thought that everybody combining their attacks was so epic.
Yeah, and I mean, even Mamoru got to get in on it, with the return of Tuxedo Lost Smoking Bomber.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, he just gets that, like, once a season.
Hey, that's enough. That's all I need. It's that good, you know? And then, like, Pharaoh 90 absorbing everyone's attacks and breaking out of the barrier was, like, really a sight to behold. As reminiscent as it may be to, like, Metalia, it's, like, it feels so different, and the impact and everything of it plays so differently, and I just loved it. Speaking of which, the rocking metal in the background as Pharaoh 90 was, like, rising and growing in power was amazing.
Yeah, this episode did have a lot of really good music going on.
Okay, so then, like, Usagi's resolve, which I kind of want to just... I'll just say her resolve was beautiful, and, like, her soliloquy hit me hard, very, very hard, and I loved every ounce of pain that it wrought. And, I don't know, we can have an extended discussion on that if need be. And then my last thing is, Saturn's costume is fantastic.
It is. She's always had one of my favorite, you know, costumes of the group of them. She's got a lot of nice little details. I also really loved the double rainbow, or the moon, rainbow moon double heartache. I can't remember the order of the words.
They're all in there somewhere, though.
Yeah, it's those 4 words in some order. And I love how they chose to animate the stock footage for it. Because Usagi and Chibiusa look fierce. Like, a lot of the stock footage, you know, the girls are smiling, all, you know, confident and excited, but in this, the two of them are like, no, this is it, we totally intend to kill you. and, you know, I always love a good double attack, good double rider kick.
Or the, love Sekiha Tenkyoken, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's beautiful stuff. But yeah, this definitely was a great attack. And I was a little surprised by it for some reason that it happened that way, even though I saw they crossed their rods in the last episode, but it didn't quite play the same. I don't know. It was like building up to it, but it cut off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it was. So I guess they were giving you context in the beginning, but it also kind of slowed things down. Anyway, great attack. So, I have a couple questions, and you certainly have answers, so let's go ahead and get through them. My first question was, we talked about Usagi basically being God in the past. Like, do you think her sacrificing herself to save others is a part of her apotheosis, or is it an expression of her heroism?
I'm not quite ready to call this her apotheosis, just because we've got two more arcs, and I know what happens in the last one. But this is definitely, at bare minimum, a reflection on how far Usagi has risen from the beginning through the trials she's faced so far. And she's watched everyone fight and fall to protect her, and she just stood with all of them, Tuxedo Mask included, like, as they poured all that they had into trying to save the world. And her friends and loved ones have given their lives for her at least twice before. And now she's strong enough to do the same for them. And, you know, that's really about as brave and heroic as it gets. On a related note, I thought Haruka's reaction to all of that was very interesting and kind of speaks a lot about the emotions that we've talked about Haruka carrying throughout this season. She wanted to protect Usagi directly by her own hand, and her duty has always been to guard from a distance. And it's this really thankless and lonely job, as we've seen. And she knows about the emotional connection that Usagi has with the other girls, and I think on some level she wants to be part of that. And I know we've gone back and forth on, like, the nature of her feelings, and, you know, to me it still doesn't read as romantic as far as Usagi's concerned. Even with the physical side that I think is just part of Haruka's nature and how she handles reacting to her own emotions, she definitely does love Usagi on a level, even if it's not a romantic one, and she wants to have that emotional connection that Usagi has with everyone else. I also thought it was really interesting how everyone regarded Usagi as Super Sailor Moon or Sailor Moon, as this is going on, as she's falling into Pharaoh 90, except for Mamoru and Luna, who both refer to her in very affectionate ways. Mamoru calls her Usa, Luna calls her Usagi-chan. And then eventually Chibiusa, as she drops the formality of dressing Sailor Moon as, like, this idol figure, and just cries out for her mother. I'm not exactly sure what my feelings are on it, but it's something that stuck out to me and I thought was, you know, worth noting.
I think on that last point, and all of the proceeding was good, and I felt like, you know, you brought up some really good points. But, like, on her calling her mama, I wonder how much of that is, like, the final step or, like, just another step forward in their relationship. Because, you know, we've all been through this before. It was antagonistic. There was jealousy. I mean, Black Lady happened.
Yeah, she did.
It was very rivalrous at that point. And then we've seen over the course of this season that their relationship is stronger and more intimate and friendlier and amicable. But, like, her crying out to her mama, that goes beyond amicable. And especially with the scene that we had of, you know, Neo Queen Serenity telling Small Lady about Super Sailor Moon and, like, how awesome she is. The irony is, like, Usagi never comes off as arrogant, and even Neo Queen Serenity doesn't feel arrogant at all. She just is a woman who knows that she... Oh, sorry. Like, what she's been through, and, like, is proud to say, like, yeah, I rocked the hell out of that situation.
Yeah, she's like, so, look, you are gonna love this once you get there, believe me. I was there, I've seen it, you're gonna love it.
So, like, that's really cool, but, like, you know, it's kind of... We had spoken about, when we were specifically talking about Chibiusa in detail during the whole Black Moon Clan thing, that, like, there was this great gulf, this chasm between her and her mother, and, like, in going and hanging out with her, you know, teenage mom, like, she's gotten a chance to know her in a much closer way, and, like, I feel like that's always been kind of at a distance. Like, yeah, this is going to be my mom, and
yeah,
she's my mom now, and I love her, but, like, it's not the same person. But, like, I feel like this is just a step towards tearing down that barrier, and, like, it's just more... She's, like, more fully feeling, like, this really is my mom, and, like, that means so much to me that I have this relationship with her. And I, that's just really great.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree on all of that. I definitely feel like there's some part of Chibiusa that accepts that now she has a relationship with her mother that all of a sudden she's losing. Because Usagi, even though she's from a future where her mother is alive,
yeah,
like, in the moment she can't even conceive that. It's just, my mother is willingly falling to her death. Or what could be her death, regardless of the fact that I should know that it's not.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the strength in this. Like, we know about Neo Queen Serenity, and still, seeing Usagi form that resolve and come to that conclusion, and just the way she lays it out to herself before she calls upon the Moon Chalice and descends into this, you know, abyss, like, she's laying it all on the line, and she's willing to give up her life, and I guess that's the most important part. I asked the question, is it apotheosis or just, you know, an expression of her heroes? And I'll go with, it could really be either. Because in a way, you know, referring to Kamen Rider Ghost, heroes do take on kind of a powerful spiritual, you know, quasi-legendary slash, like, you know, demi-divine aspect to them, especially with, like, the way the impact of their actions reverberates throughout history and, like, can have a lasting effect. And that can happen with normal people, too. But, like, when someone reaches the level of icon because, you know, whatever the particular circumstances are, like, that really makes them last. And it's just interesting. Like, even if she wasn't going to become, you know, basically God in the future, she definitely marks herself out a real place in history for what she's doing here. And
yes,
that's pretty neat. And it's all out of love and care and concern for others. And, like, she would never think about, like, oh, in the future they'll be thinking about me because of this great thing I did, and I'll go down in history, because, like, none of that matters.
No. She's just, there are people that I love, and they need this right now, so I'm going to do it.
Man, she's so good.
I know.
Oh. Okay, so, second question, 10 minutes later. What are your thoughts on Saturn's debut, and how do you read her?
For starters, her awakening animation was beautiful. Just Saturn separating herself from Mistress Nine and, you know, coming into existence through what's left of Hotaru. This was really interesting for me to experience because I'm so used to the Saturn that comes after this. You know, in the later arcs, that I don't really remember this first awakening out of Mistress Nine, and she's given a lot of really interesting expressions and this really analytical nature, but she's got this very slight edge of snark on her where her first reaction coming out is like, as always, I'm this uninvited guest to the party and no one really wants me here. that just reminds me of when Hotaru was just sassing Mistress Nine. It's also interesting that she takes the time to tell everyone, like, what went wrong in the timeline, and to actually, like, physically punish Pharaoh 90, when, you know, the story of her last appearance kind of makes all of that seem unnecessary, where she wouldn't need to, she can just swing the glaive down and that's that. Where she kind of takes the time to talk to everyone and beat up this bad dude. I feel like Saturn really wants to show the personality she's got and interact with the other Guardians, but she knows what her role is, and she figures there's not really any point since 5 minutes after she shows up, everything's gonna be gone.
I really do think it's interesting that we get this aspect of her going ahead and like you said, punishing Pharaoh 90, and I wonder how much of that is just because by circumstance, you know, she was vesselized and turned into Mistress Nine, and Mistress Nine was a, like, very aggressively trying to hurt. I mean, this is Hotaru's awakened self, so, like, she loves Chibiusa, and Mistress Nine murdered her, like, straight up murdered her, ripped her soul out of her body. So, like, I can definitely understand her having this extra edge and the fact that Mistress Nine and Verona 90 are, you know, this merged being. She would want to do as much as she could to make him suffer before destroying everything. So, like, that was pretty cool. I definitely read her as dark. Like, it was cool, though, the way it was done, because there is that snark, like you said, and it's not like, she almost has, like, gallows humor, you know? Like, everything's going to be destroyed, so I may as well enjoy myself for this little while before it is. So, like, that was pretty interesting. I'm still super curious about, like, how it's all going to play out, but, I mean, that's getting more speculative and getting off the point of the question. So, I don't know, she's very interesting, and I like her a lot. And I actually, how different does she look? Like, she's an older version of Otaru, right?
Not really. I mean, she just has a very different facial expression.
Okay.
She has this much more serious expression, where Otaru was always kind of very passive. Where Saturn, at least for now, isn't. And I think that kind of gives her a bit of an older feel.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, because I was, like, I was struggling looking at her. I mean, I couldn't get past the costume, for one. But two, to look at her, it was like, well, I can't really tell, like, is this an aged up, or is she just more... But I think you're right, it's the intensity. And I think that's pretty interesting, because, like, being passive isn't a bad thing, necessarily. And it's not this, like, flaw that needs to be rooted out of people. So it'll be really interesting to see, like, what, again, getting speculative, like, how that plays with her. And it'll be kind of interesting to see if she almost has, like, this duality to her in the future. Like, when it's time to kick ass, she's going to get as intense as she needs to be. And when it's not, then she'll, you know, relax. But anyway, let's move on from that. What do you suppose caused this twist in fate? And is Otaru living part... Is Otaru living, you know, past the fire, part of what brought Earth to Pharaoh 90's attention?
Cyborg Otaru, and, you know, by the way, she is a cyborg. Make her a Kamen Rider.
I wanted to clue everybody into the fact that I pasted in a couple pictures of Makoto Kijima, I believe is her name, from Persona 5. She's riding a motorcycle and is wearing a mask. So she's literally a masked rider, and just, like, her look.
She's got a big old scarf.
Yeah, she does have a big old scarf, and, like, crazy spiked brass knuckles, so, like, those are all good things. But, like, she feels to me, like, a little bit of... I get a Otaru feel from her for some reason. Just the little glimpses I've seen of her, she's, like, student council president and stuff like that, so maybe because she's, like, a biggie in the school, and she has a relative who's important to the plot, maybe those things, and, like... seeing this edge on Awakened Otaru in Saturn, like, all those things kind of gelled in my head, and I thought, like, wow, very similar. So, like, here's, you know, you can pretend this is Otaru if you want, as
yes.
a writer.
But this anyway. This is good, and I am pleased.
Yeah, please continue, though.
But, you know, Cyborg Kamen Rider Otaru, definitely seems to be the point at which this timeline splits off from whatever I guess it was supposed to be. It seems like Professor Tomoe was just a little more morally challenged than he was supposed to be, and that led him to turning his daughter into a cyborg instead of letting her stay dead, and thus attracting Pharaoh 90 to him through that madness, and allowing, you know, him and his daughter, his cyborg daughter, to become vessels for an evil alien, and this really sounds like a Showa Kamen Rider plot.
Yeah, kinda. There's this really awful thing in the Black manga where this guy, this scientist, is using his daughter to, like, incubate Kaijin for him, and it's, like, it's really terrible. So, I guess spoilers on the Kamen Rider Black manga. Anyway. Yeah, you know, as you were talking about Tomoe, I was thinking, I wonder if, like, she was supposed to die to avoid her awakening, to avoid, you know, the wiping out of all existence. If, like, she had been maybe reincarnated multiple times throughout history, and, like, that girl had just you know, continued to die before there was a chance. Like, maybe if the talismans weren't activated, then she wouldn't have needed to die early because the talismans were around because of the, you know, the 3-0, or the outers, like, being around and having their talismans. Like, I wonder if, like, that condition means she has to die, and, like, if this had happened 200 years ago, if, you know, Tomoe wouldn't have had the technology for her to live, and that's why, you know, the circumstances just made this happen.
Yeah, and, I mean, Saturn kind of says that, like, this series of weird coincidences led to the world ending.
Yeah, I guess you're right. She does explicitly say that, so. It's just, it's really weird from, like, a narrative standpoint, though, because, like, I don't know, it just, it's an very interesting concept to, like, try to turn around and examine from all different sides, but it's kind of slippery, so it's hard to. For me, anyway.
I'm not sure about the talismans, though, because the first time it happens, all three of them are on separate planets. All three
true.
Of the outers. And they're kind of summoned to a place in order to bring her out.
You mean with Metalia, right?
Yes.
I thought they all,
the
like,
first time.
I thought they all warped to Saturn, and there was, like, a temple there.
Yeah.
And then they
did the thing.
Right.
But they'd all been on their own planet, so it's not as though the talismans needed to be together.
Hmm. Okay. I kind of see what you're saying, but I'm just wondering, I'm coming from, like, the talismans being in such, like, all being in, what, Tokyo, right?
Yes.
Like, at the same time, I don't know. What I was saying is I wonder if them all being in Tokyo at the same time while Cyborg Hotaru is alive, is part of the problem. And, like, had they all been on their different planets, if she wouldn't have had to die. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, she would have then died anyway because the world would have ended, but...
I guess that's true. I don't know, it's weird. Like I said, it's, like, difficult for me to wrestle with. Let's go to the next question, though. Does the time logic, and since we're kind of edging towards her anyway, does that make sense in all this? Should everyone in the show, like, take for granted that they will make it through and... like, that Usagi will be fine?
I mean, I take it for granted because I know there's two whole story arcs left, but, you know, no one in the show actually seems to be, like, thinking this is gonna work out. They all see Saturn and just the entire cast is like, well, that's it, we're screwed. We're done. It's over. And I think it's interesting, though, that Saturn seems to exist outside of this time cycle that she keeps resetting. Like, she's seen this before and knows how it's supposed to go. And then Hotaru didn't die in that fire, and she's like, well, this was a doomed timeline, so, you know, it's about time that I get out here and end it.
I don't know. This is such, like, a weird thing for me to think about, because, like, I guess it makes sense. I'll concede that it's fine. It seems a little funny to me that the cast doesn't see or even have, like, a glimmer of hope. Like, well, maybe this will work out anyway because, you know, we've been to the future and now we're back, so we should arrive at that future at some point. But then again, like, I'm sure it's changing things. Like, I'm sure the Neo Queen Serenity that Usagi and everybody else met, like, didn't have Chibiusa hanging out with her as a teenager. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I know there's, like three or four different, like, time loop, like, narrative structures for doing time travel. So, like, that's what kind of throws me off.
Yeah. It's also just a little weird because Pluto is, like, the guardian of time.
Right.
And...
yeah, she is.
She is unaware of this weird time anomaly.
Yeah, that's because she's time and space, so she knows she senses the space distortion and talks about it, but
yeah.
She hasn't mentioned the time distortion.
It's very, because I mean she has time travel keys on her hip as this is going on. That, I mean, that was the entire plot of the last arc. Right. Is that time travel happened because Chibs stole her stuff.
Yeah, you think she might use that right now?
Yeah, you know, just be like, okay, everyone, we are going to take 5 minutes. We are going to go dig Usagi out of that.
You know, it's funny that you mention that and you call that out, but it's kind of like the characters in the show. I'm so compelled by everything else that's going on that that never occurs to me. And it doesn't matter because, like, what's going on is so intense and so compelling that I don't see it, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think is a strength.
Yeah, no, the story is definitely strong enough where you don't really think of these things as it's happening. It's one of those things where after the fact you're like, but wait, there's maybe these other options.
Like, if you wanted to get crazy, you know, you know, Pluto could grab Chibiusa and Usa, like, a few sets of them and bring them forth to help attack all at the same time, right?
Yeah, no, just, like, just get, like, 10 of them and have them all do, like, the double Rainbow Moon Heartache.
Sure. And you'd think that would work.
I mean, or at least, you know, stop everything, go get Neo Queen Serenity, and just be like, hey, a bad thing is happening. You might want to do something so that, you know, younger you doesn't die.
Yeah, if you want to keep living, you might want to intervene this one time.
You know, I know we've got these rules, but I mean, we just broke them like a month ago. So, not sure how strict on this we are anymore.
Well, I mean, and if she's God, she can just kind of... Don't worry about this one for right now, you know?
Yeah.
So, man, that's interesting. Yeah, there's all these different possibilities, but, I mean, at the same time, so, like, one, it's a strength of the story, or a marker of how strong it is that you don't really question it as it's going on, and two, you know, Usagi needs to stand on her own, and if that means dying and then bringing herself back or coming back somehow, then, like, so be it. But, like, emotionally and for her character arc, she needs to go through this trial. And, like, it's very, you know, I make the reference to scripture in the title of the episode, No Greater Love. And it's very much like, wow, oh my gosh, this is so cool. So, like, there's the line in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, take this cup for me if it's your will. Because, like, I'd rather not die. I'm like, I'm cool with it, but I'd rather not. And Usagi basically kind of has a moment like that. She calls this chalice, this cup, to her, and is saying, like, I'll do this if I have to protect my friends. And, like, that's pretty darn cool. That there's this, you know, theme. And you can be agnostic, atheist, anti-religion, whatever. It's interesting because, like, those themes from, you know, the death and resurrection of Christ are, like, they kind of permeate some storytelling, and, like, I think they're pretty strong, and they're kind of sweet, because, like, dying so that others would live and have life and have it more abundantly is, like, touching and good, and it's what Usagi's doing here, and I just think that's really neat.
Yes, and I mean, like, that's always a really good thing to see be written well, because you can also write it terribly. Pretty sure, like, we all know exactly what I'm thinking of.
Oh, yes. Yes, you mean, like, you know, when you have something on your counter that grows on a tree, and then it gets all moldy, and then you throw it in the trash can, because it's trash fruit, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Just, you know. And, I mean, just, you know, this is doing it well. Ghost is also doing it very well.
It is.
It's probably something that Zuojer might do with the world, since we like killing off our sixths anymore. That seems to have become a habit in the past couple of years.
And if you think about the art from the original version of the world card.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of neat, neat little, you know, biblical references all over the place, and you can do it well, where it doesn't feel invasive, or you can do it terribly.
Did you say invasive? Oh. I'm sorry. By the way, everybody, that's Kamen Rider Trash Fruit, and that's one you don't have to bother watching.
Yeah, you can basically skip, like, 2014 and 2015. You really don't need to.
Actually, you know what? I forgot. There was High Octane Christ, too. Not just, you know, moldy trash fruit
Oh,
Christ,
God,
so.
Yeah, he also kind of...
Right?
I mean, that... definitely felt like more of like a ripoff of other Kamen Rider things. That definitely felt more like they wanted to do what Forze did.
Right.
Even though that was definitely a case of Space Jesus. but like Gaim was very, very heavy-handed in its like biblical references. And Norse mythology references for some reason.
Hey, why not, right?
In the weirdest combination of religions.
You know, I just gotta make another comment about Sailor Moon, and I kind of think I talked about this before. Like, Usagi is, not host, but, like, custodian of the greatest power in existence, and Mai was custodian, sort of the greatest power in existence, and, like, it disempowered her and got her murdered, basically.
Pretty much.
And I'm sorry. I don't know how much you know, and I don't want to upset you, but,
I know some things.
Yeah. I wrote, like, a really, really long article after that about how Gaim is dangerous and toxic, and, like, I don't want children seeing it, because, like, it's bad. And it perpetuates a lot of bad things. And I know... like, it's not the only problematic piece of media, but, like, as far as I know or understand, Kamen Rider is, like, pretty popular in Japan, and the fact that it just got approved.
It's the only Kamen Rider that I've never finished. It is the only one that I have not completed. Whether I liked them or not, I made my way to the end of every other one I've watched, because I felt like I couldn't properly judge it without knowing the entire story. But with Gaim, it was just like, no. The only one requiring me to do this is me. And I'm leaving. I don't care about judging it. It doesn't mean enough to me.
And to clarify for any listeners who don't know, Sono, you've seen, what, Kuga Through Ghost?
I have seen Kuga Amazon. Through Ghost, Amazon, 3 episodes of Stronger, and 1 episode of Black. And the only reason I haven't gone back to Stronger and Black is a lack of time, not a lack of, you know, motivation. because I definitely want to watch both of those.
I say anytime you watch Black is a good time, so, you know, whenever
but,
you can.
Yeah, I have watched literally every Heisei Kamen Rider. Every single one. So, I've watched G, which is amazing, so and everyone should watch G. It's like 20 minutes long. It's not even a full episode. Like, it's ridiculous and amazing, and is one of my favorite Kamen Riders. And I mean, like, pretty much except Kuga. I can say Kuga's a pretty notable exception. They all have, you know, their own handful of problematic elements, as, you know, does everything. I can't think of a single thing that's problematic in Kuga, offhand. Kuga might be perfect. Just a little bit. But, as I channel Aelif.
And you love Blade. So,
I
like,
do.
And that has its problems, right?
It has its fair share of problems, notably Mutsuki. He is troublesome in some ways. And, you know, there's some other things that are, you know, problematic. Kiva. I love Kiva.
Oh, yeah.
But Jiro exists.
This is true. And Otoya.
Yeah, Otoya. I can deal with Otoya because everyone treats Otoya as the problem he is.
This is true.
But no, like, the show doesn't treat Jiro and what he did as wrong. And that, like, if a show, if there's a problematic thing in a show and the show treats it as a problem, I'm not willing to fault it for that.
Mm-hmm.
But Jiro's entire storyline culminated to what it did. And no one ever called him out on it. And
you're right.
It is easily pretty far up there on the most problematic things you could do.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not called out on it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I love Kiba. There are problems in Double. There are problems in Forze. There are some very problematic things in Forze, but I still think that's a very important show. And, I mean, with Kiva, I went on a small rant today about how great Wataru is. Because for all the problems in Kiva, he is zero of them.
This is true. He's beautiful, but...
He is.
we've been veering way off onto the Kamen Rider Road, but, like, that's all to say... That, I mean, I remember a couple weeks ago I was talking about how, like, I really, really like Kamen Rider, but I think I kind of like Sailor Moon better, and it's better overall. I think the reason I said that is because Sailor Moon avoids, and it's only one show and one story with one creator, but in its run, it's avoided a lot of problematic things that I've seen just in the last couple years of Kamen Rider that have popped up recently, and I'm not saying there aren't others, it's just I've only watched like 5 series, so I don't know the width and breadth of Kamen Rider's problematic elements, but like Sailor Moon has none of them, or it may overlap, but it's a small overlap, I believe.
Yeah, it's Sailor Moon doesn't have a lot of problematic elements. There are some here and there, as there are in basically every piece of media, because nothing is perfect, maybe except Kuga. Again, because I honestly can't think of one thing Kuga did wrong offhand. But again, it's been maybe like 2 years since I've watched Kuga, so slight bias probably. But, I mean, there's so much good in Sailor Moon that it balances out. And I think any problematic things in Sailor Moon are done well-intentioned, which, you know, doesn't make them not problematic, but
right.
I don't think they're done to push a problematic agenda.
Yeah, and the same can't be said for some of the things that we've seen recently.
Yeah. When didn't Kiriko get kidnapped?
Kiriko? Oh, man, it was right before Chaser debuted. Chaser debuted.
It was the Bokenger arc.
Yeah, you're right.
Did not get kidnapped, and then he showed up immediately after. But pretty much any time they could kidnap her, they did.
And it was always followed by the Princess Gary, right?
Yes, every single time.
Because she can't walk on her own, despite the fact that she had... like, could deliver a rider kick and flip. She flipped over a fence in the first episode, if you'd remember.
Yes. from a standing position, I don't think she even took a run at it. She just jumped over that fence. She's able to deliver a rider kick out of suit that is strong enough to disable a second form. Like, she's easily the most competent person in the room, is what I'm trying to say, for people unfamiliar with Drive. She's easily the most competent person in the room, and is treated as though she is Princess Peach. You know, nothing against Princess Peach, because I know in the character development that she's gotten in, you know, comics and, you know, later Mario games that have more developed story, Peach is actually... kind of awesome.
Like, doesn't she rock all over Paper Mario?
I'm not sure. I don't know much about Paper Mario, but I know, like, there's some comics where she just outright... Oh, no, there is some stuff with her in Paper Mario, where, like, Paper Peach and regular Peach are like, you know what? This is dumb. Let's go dye our hair and be awesome. I've seen a couple of things with that. I haven't played any of the Paper Mario games, so I don't know the extent of it. But, I mean, she's treated as, like, very early Princess Peach, like Super Mario World Princess Peach, where, you know, you don't even see her mentioned until the end of the game. Like, the opening of the game is Yoshi being like, hey, my friends were kidnapped. You need to save them from Bowser. And then at the end, Bowser also has Peach. Where, like, she's this odd footnote to the story. And that's kind of how Drive treats Kiriko.
Yeah, definitely. And yet, it built her up in so many ways.
It's so weird. Drive is a weird show that was ruined by a bad producer. But
had a lot of good elements.
And, like, the thing is, no one really gets... I mean, Usagi gets kidnapped in the Black Moon arc, but she breaks herself out of that. She's just you know what? This is weird and creepy, and I'm just gonna leave. I'm gonna get my friends out of the basement and go. Like, Mamoru's role is never rescue Usagi, and Usagi's role is never rescue Mamoru.
Right.
They exist to support each other, whatever that may mean, given the situation.
Yeah, her role may be at a time to fight Mamoru, but that's okay, too.
Yeah, I mean, that happens in life. You fight people you care about, and either, you know, you move on without them, or you find a middle ground, and you make things work. Metaphors for life, people.
And you can make them action-packed and dramatic, and that's okay,
yeah,
right?
Of course. But, you know, I think where we're going with this whole deviation is that, you know, a lot of... Even though there are things here that could be written differently within this and other arcs of Sailor Moon, everything feels strong enough to stand as it is. I never find myself questioning, why don't they do this other thing instead? Until I'm just like, you know, what would be a neat alternate scenario? Like, I feel very content with everything that happens as a narrative.
Yeah.
Regardless of how much it breaks my heart.
Well, that's part of the joy, isn't it?
Yes.
There was a movie recently that I saw a Blu-ray for, and I thought, I need to get this. And I thought, well, but you'll cry at the end. And I thought, that's okay. It's all right. I don't mind. I want to cry again. But anyway, we should go ahead and conclude now.
Yes. Now that we've talked for maybe half an hour about Kamen Rider.
Yeah, sorry about that, everybody. But it was all good, and it all did lead back into discussions of Sailor Moon and, like, reasons we enjoy it so much.
Yes.
You know, alongside this other thing we enjoy.
It was all, you know, it helped emphasize things. And, you know, if we've gotten you interested in Kamen Rider through talking about it, as we sometimes do on this show, you know, since we're reaching out to Sailor Moon fans, maybe start with Wizard.
Just
with,
great.
With how many parallels we keep drawing, and how often I think Wizard is just an alternate universe Kamen Rider Sailor Moon. in some ways. In many ways. And I think Wizard's a pretty decent place to start. I think it, you know, falls true enough to the form of Kamen Rider.
Yeah, I think definitely. And especially, like, more modern Kamen Rider, it's got all the toyetic elements, and you'll get baptized in the fire that is, you know, children's toys singing at you as guys are fighting.
That is Tamashii Nations trying to sell you, little figures. In the scale,
and
in the same line as the Sailor Moon figure arts.
This is true.
So,
and
you know they're good.
And he has magical little rings.
Yes, he's got magical little rings, magical little animals.
Oh man, the Famus are so cute.
I love them. you know, he's got a dragon.
This is true, he rides a dragon.
He does. he is a dragon. So, I mean, you know, give it a shot if you're looking for a thing. If you're looking for something new to get into.
And if you really want to hear people podcasting about it, you can always ask me and I'll hook you up with me talking about it for like Well, the whole series. So, we can always discuss it with Sona. It could be fun, a fun Twitter back and forth.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yes, always. Everyone should come talk to me about Wizard. I love talking about Wizard.
And Sona's written, like, if you look at that, she's written a bunch of good stuff that's on her Tumblr about Wizard too. So, like,
yes,
there's a lot to enjoy outside of just the show itself.
Wizard and Forze was back, before I was on the show, so I just wrote everything down and, you know, spewed it into the void of Tumblr, in a completely unconstructive manner. But I've written a lot on Wizard, cause it has some really interesting, narrative structure, some really interesting messages. A very interesting hero, regardless of what some people in this fandom may tell you.
Yeah. Hey, here's another one of my ridiculous anagram type things. Hotaru Haruto.
Oh. Hmm.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right, we really should stop before we spin off into something
else. I will continue talking about Wizards, so I need to be stopped immediately. Before I bring up Rinko, and then we're all hope is lost, and you're gonna need to call Hotaru in here to end the universe.
Oh man, yeah, we don't need Saturn Awakening. So let's go ahead and conclude. Everybody, you should check out Sono's Patreon, which is patreon.com/watermelonbees. Correct?
Yes, I did post a comic today. It's a little late, but I think it's a good joke. And,
I don't even know the characters, and I thought it was cute and funny.
Everyone will eventually, once I finally, you know, am making enough money every month to be able to devote time to this game. It is the main antagonist and main protagonist of the Kamen Rider-inspired game that I'm working on. But I do...
Would you like to share its title?
the game itself? The game itself is called Decode, but that title is not final. Mm. If I can think of something better as I'm working on it, but you know that's kind of the main project that I'm working towards doing, and my patrons are a big help with getting me towards being able to work on that full time. All of my backers get y'all get a free patch of your choice. Anything you want. I'm also going to be doing bottle cap charms soon, so I'm thinking about making it an either or, and you can get either one if for some reason, you know, you have nothing you want to do with an embroidered patch. You could get a little bottle cap charm to have as a keychain or something.
That sounds cute.
And, you know, for further up tiers, get more stuff. The comics that I do, as every week, hopefully, when I can, are for everyone. They go up regardless of what your pledge level is. Further ups, you can get early releases of things, music that I compose for the games that I'm working on, actual assets that you can play with if, you know, you have some game design software and just need some assets so you can play around with the coding. I give those out to higher tiers. So, you know, take a look, maybe, see what's there. When I get to $200 a month, I will be doing tutorials, at the request of my backers. Whatever y'all want me to show you how I do a thing, I will show you. We're currently about $60 away from that, I think. So, you know. Take a look if you're interested. There's also my Etsy shop, brandnewlovesong.etsy.com, where I sell patches and, you know, soon bottle cap charms once I get the supplies for that in. And, you know, whatever else. I take custom orders for anything y'all want, really, that you think I could do.
And you also do art commissions as well, right?
Yes, I do. I do both art and writing commissions. You can find that somewhere within my Tumblr. I think if you go to my Tumblr and you just click the link that says tags, I believe I have a link to my commissions page in there, or you can go to, I believe, watermelonbees.com, and I think I have a link there that leads right to my commission rates. So, you know, if you're interested in that, feel free to contact me wherever about an art or writing commission. I'm Mama Fry's Meal at both Twitter and Tumblr. You can just hit me up. I'll link you to my commission rates if you're interested. That's not a big deal. I can dig that up for you. My rates are pretty reasonable, I think. So, you know, hit me up if you're interested in something. I'm also working on a plush doll commission right now, so if that's a thing you're interested in, you can talk to me about that in the future. Or now. Whatever.
Well, there's lots of opportunities to help Sono out and get someone for yourself, too, in return. So
I will make you literally anything you want. I will find a way to make it happen.
All right, and we'll go ahead and close out then. I don't really have anything to plug because I'm just a guy who's trying to help out some of these friends I've made, you know, because I think everyone else is better than me. So, like, y'all are great, and anything I can do to help you guys is good.
I appreciate it.
I guess until next time, farewell is all I really have to say.
Yes, we will see y'all next week, I guess.
Yeah, because our work is done here.
Yes.
Actually, our work is not done here, because we're coming from the future, like Chibi Usa, to, like, throw a wrench in things. Wouldn't you say that's an accurate description of what she did?
Pretty much. I mean, she just dropped out of the sky and pointed a gun at her mom.
This is true. Yeah, that makes it even worse when you really think of, when you know the whole story. Like, hey, that's your mom. What are you doing pointing a fake gun at her? Ah, man. The Electra Complex is, serious in that show, huh? Sorry. Alright, so we're not here to talk about Electra Complex or anything else. What we are here to talk about is the fact that I checked out the dub, the first episode of the dub of Sailor Moon Crystal, because, like, that's a thing, and that's cool. And as I understand it, the lady, oh man, I cannot remember, Deb something. Is her name Deb Crane? That's a weird... I don't know why. Anyway, the same lady who's writing the 90s dub for Viz is also doing Crystal's dub. And it's the same vocal cast, or at least most everybody overlaps, as I understand it. So I decided, well, I've seen like 10 episodes of the 90s dub, the Viz... Well, I'm sorry, not the 90s dub, the 90s anime with the new dub. So I may as well check out Crystal, because I'm way more familiar with that. And... Sona, have you checked it out by any chance?
I have not. So I am going to see what you recommend.
Well, I feel badly saying this, but, like, only watch it if you're willing to put up with that animation again. Because, like, the dub itself was fine. And it was actually, like, really cool to hear... the guys, like, I think Jadeite's in the first episode, and, like, it was cool to hear him in English again, but, like, with this new, or, you know, with the guy from the 90s anime, the new one, and, like, that was really cool, and he sounded really intimidating, and, like, I don't think I really got that from him and the rest of the guys that Beryl was bossing around, like, man, who's the guy with, like, the silver hair?
Is that Kunzite, I think.
Like, Kunzite was the most intimidating and badass of all those guys. But, like, the rest of them were kind of, like, fair to midland for me. But, like, in the English, Jadeite is awesome. So, like, that's pretty cool. Like, you've got a recommendation there. But I was really shocked to look at it again. And some of the faces they give Usagi and just, like, the way her model is designed for Crystal is, like, really different from... Crystal Season 3, and I'm so thankful that they changed it. I know we spoke a lot about the change in animation from 1 to 1, but or from, like, the end of Black Moon to the beginning of Mugen, but, like, it's really, really different, and it's almost shocking. But it was funny, the rest of the girls look a little more like themselves, but Usagi definitely, like, has different faces.
I still very much have episode 2 of Crystal still burned into my mind with the horrible animation errors on Ami.
Okay.
Like, rewatch it and just look at her. Because there are some cuts that are, like, close-up cuts that last for several seconds on her face. And it's bad.
Yeah. Like, the good thing about the dub is, though, you don't have to look at it that hard, because it's, you know, you're not reading all the subs. But at the same time, I wonder, like, and I kind of remember vaguely that when we talked about it, and I was like, I don't know from animation, because, like, I watch old anime still, and, like, it doesn't really bother me. And it, you know, it got better over the course of the series, but going back after having seen so much of this season 3, the difference is huge, and probably actually not having the subs there allows me to take in better everyone's faces, because I'm not the quickest reader. So maybe I spend half the time of a frame or like a scene showing the subs and the person's face. Like, I probably spend around half the time looking at the subs themselves. So, like, that's kind of an issue for me. But, like, I really got to take it in visually, and it's an inferior product, I'm sorry to say, in certain ways. And I'm not trying to bash it. I'm just, it's interesting that I've gained that perspective now. So, I don't know. That was a primary thing I wanted to talk about, just, like, how deep the difference is from one to the other.
They've really stepped up the animation in season 3, and they're working weekly now instead of bi-weekly.
This is true, and they probably have less money overall, I would think, because of that.
I'm not sure. Well, I have to assume they've gotten a bigger budget now, because, I mean, it looks so much better, and there's so much that's not like, all of the stock footage isn't CGI sequences.
Right.
But, and the first season was supposed to air a lot sooner than it did. It was delayed several times by, like, a year.
Oh, well.
possibly more than a year.
That's a lot.
And there were still all of those animation problems. Which is really where a lot of the backlash towards the first season of Crystal came from. The fandom was kind of divided into two camps, on people that loved it and people that hated it. And I know that a lot of the issue in the people that really didn't like it came from these animation issues, because they are pretty bad. And I mean, season 3 still has some flaws in its animation, but they're not glaring the way earlier ones are, where you kind of have to stop and really look at things to notice them, or, you know, be kind of trained to spot them. Like, I've taken anatomy drawings, so there are things where if something in the face isn't positioned quite right, it kind of sets something off in me. But I know that if I hadn't been, like, forced to learn how to see that for my own skills, I wouldn't notice it at all. Because I know when I was younger, I didn't. But season 1, especially, was a little bit of a mess.
Yeah. I'll be interested to watch more of season 1, the dub, and see, like, how much more of it I pick up on. Because, like, Mamoru looks pretty similar to how he does now. Like, I almost think he's one for one between the two, or between, like, the beginning and what we have in Crystal season 3. So, like, it's kind of interesting that they got him so correct. But I can't remember some, like, him maybe looking, like, extra gangly a couple times, so... Or, like, didn't his arm there's... bend in an unnatural way in an episode?
Yeah, there, I know there was, I think towards the very, very end of Dark Kingdom, there was some shot with his arm that made absolutely no sense, where, like, his arm was longer than his body.
Well, he's a Digimon, then.
it happens.
I guess so. Never mind, I was going to say something really terrible. Anyway, so, like, yeah, that's interesting. But if I continue to watch, I'll go ahead and make reports every now and then about what I'm seeing. But that was kind of all I wanted to bring up, because I've noticed a lot of people are checking out, like, the older episodes from, you know, Moonspeak Phase 1, which covered the first, 26 episodes of Crystal. And I wonder how much of that's because of the dub going on. And so, like, maybe people who are checking out the dub are checking out those old episodes. And I guess I just kind of wanted to share a different perspective on what we'd said about the animation there.
Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely, maybe I'll check out the dub of the 90s series, just to hear the acting, which I'm sure, they do a good job with. I remember seeing some clips. I remember not being totally sold on Luna. And again, this was, the acting in the 90s dub. But everyone else sounded really great.
Yeah, I really did like, there was a, I can't remember if it was, I think Luna and her teacher, Miss, I can't remember her name right now.
Haruna.
Haruna, there we go. Sounded a little similar. Oh, and I was also surprised by, like, and this is both in the dub and the subtitled original version, like, they really changed the look of Miss Haruna between the 90s anime and the this modern one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they even, Usagi's mom is fairly different. Haruna, I think, was probably a bit more streamlined for the 90s series, whereas Crystal Haruna is maybe a little closer to the manga.
Well, I really, speaking of Usagi's mom, I really liked her voice, her English voice. I thought, like, it's, I don't know, it, some of the characters, it's interesting, like, pop a little more to me in the Crystal dub, or, you know, I guess it would be the same as the 90s dub cast, so, like, that's pretty reassuring, because, like, I like everybody just from a, like, storytelling point of view, from what I've seen of the, you know, subtitled version of Crystal, but, like, everybody really shone in a different way for me with the English voices, and I'm sure part of that is, like, it's in my native tongue, so there are different inflections and stuff that I pick up on that I just couldn't necessarily in the Japanese version, so... like, I think it's just worth a try if you can stand dubs at all, I would say try it, because I know there are some people who are, you know, sub-only, and, I'm definitely not one of those, so.
Yeah, I'm willing to give pretty much any dub a shot. There are actually some series that I will only watch dubbed. There are few and far between, but, Baccano, I'm not quite sure on the pronunciation, because I don't know Italian. And the title is an Italian word, but I will actually, the dub, because it's set in, like, late 20s, early 30s, New York and Chicago, the dub cast really brings a lot to it in playing with the accents of the time.
Right.
That, you know, that the original Japanese voices kind of lack. Shinesman, which is a Sentai parody, it's an OVA, so it's only two episodes long, but the dub is hilarious. It's a very, very localized dub, because there are a lot of, you know, cultural jokes in it, so a lot of localizing the jokes to make sense to an American audience, but all of the jokes are hilarious. Like, they did an A-plus job on localization in that.
I would say you'd probably want to watch Excel Saga dubbed only because of, like, how it, like, it
yeah.
would work better with American
yeah,
literature,
I can...
you know?
Yeah, I can agree with that.
It's been show.
Over 10 years since I've watched Excel Saga. We are
so,
digging up the classics here.
Just as you brought up Shinesman, and you've mentioned to me before, and I've wanted to watch it, but I went ahead and pulled it up on a certain site that has to do with tubes, and, you know, you might want to check it out. It's there, dubbed, and you can check it out very easily, so, like, that's cool.
It's so good, and I will recommend... I have been recommending it to everyone for, like, 15 years. Constantly. Unfortunately, the manga that it's adapted from is kind of hard to find, so I've only read, like, maybe the first 4 or 5 chapters of it. I don't know if it's easier to find now, but when I was trying to read it several years ago, it was a little difficult to find. But it's hysterical.
Okay, cool. Well, that's something to look forward to. But before we get off on a whole different tangent, let's go ahead and really call it here, because I think we've covered what we wanted to in the addendum.
Yes, I believe so.
All right, well, I think we should call it there. and for reals this time, everybody, our work really is done here.
Yes, so we will see you next week.